Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston, where I talk to the thought leaders of the pharmaceutical industry about where our industry is headed and what you can do about it. I'm your host, Samir Gondalia. Thanks for joining us today. Our guest today is Professor Tom Webster, who is Chair and Professor of Chemical Engineering at Northeastern University, Boston. Professor Webster directs the Nanomedicine Laboratory, which designs, synthesizes, evaluates nanomaterials for various implant applications. To date, his lab group has generated over 9 textbooks, 48 book chapters, and hundreds of conference-invited presentations and peer-reviewed literature articles, in addition, 32 provisional or full patents. Some of these patents led to the formation of 9 companies. Let's hear Professor Webster's thoughts on nanomedicine and what it means for the future of the pharmaceutical industry. Welcome to the Future of Pharma with ISP Boston. Professor Webster, how are you doing today morning?
I'm doing very well. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining. So first and foremost, if you met a lawyer or an accountant at a party, how would you explain to the non-technical person about what do you do in layman's terms?
Yeah, so we often joke that we're doing big things with small materials. So I think a great way to describe nanomedicine, nanotechnology, or the things that we do is we're trying to go places that big materials can't go. So we're trying to go into cells, we're trying to penetrate skin, we're trying to infiltrate tumors, go through the blood-brain barrier, all of these areas of the body that you can't really go through with large particles, large materials, and you need small nano materials to do that. We both have hair, which is good. So if you think about the diameter of one piece of hair, if it's even possible for you to grab one piece of hair, the diameter on average is about 80,000 nanometers.
80,000, okay.
And we are creating particles for medicine that are about 8 nanometers.
8 nanometers.
You know, 80 nanometers, 8 nanometers. So we are much, much, much smaller than the average dimension of the thickness of a strand of hair. So, you know, you cannot see nanometer resolution with your eye. You can't see the particles we make with your eye. You can see them when they all clump together. And that's how we know we're making them. But when they're individual, you don't see them. So it's actually, you know, very interesting to think about all of these diseases that we have in the body and how you could use these really small particles to turn on and off switches in the cells that are responsible for those diseases. Many times we want to kill the cells that are responsible for these diseases. But there's other examples where you want to, you know, turn off just a particular way that that cell operates.
Okay.
And not necessarily kill it. So I guess, you know, another layman's way to think about nanotechnology is, since we can't see nanometer resolution with our eye, it's kind of an invisible medical treatment.
All right. By definition, nanoparticle is something which is 100 nanometers or less in at least one dimension, right?
Yeah, sort of. I think, you know, there's a lot of debate about everything in medicine and science, and I think maybe a debate is that length scale. I think the 100 nanometer or less dimension that qualifies something as a nanoparticle or as nanomedicine is a pretty valid definition. And I think where that comes from is you start seeing really changed, significantly changed properties when you start getting down to that length scale. So the term 100 nanometers really comes from, that's where you start seeing things significantly change.
Okay.
But it does not mean, at least in my mind and many other people in the field, it doesn't mean if you have a 101 nanometer particle, you're no longer nanomedicine.
Which brings me to my next question is, what kind of equipment and instruments do you need to work with something you can't even see?
Yeah.
Scanning tunneling microscope, or just naming a couple of things that I'm familiar
with.
Yeah,
absolutely. You know, and this is a great question because many people will make an argument, and I think this argument is quite valid, that we have been making and using nanoparticles for a long time, but it wasn't until we had instruments like a scanning tunneling microscope or an atomic force microscope or super high resolution scanning electron microscope. It wasn't until we had these things that we knew what we were making.
Right.
You know, in fact, there's a saying that I use a lot. You know, carbon nanotubes are very popular nanomaterial, super high strength to weight ratios, super conductivity. They have a great ability to penetrate cells and deliver drugs. Carbon nanotubes were one of the first discovery was in the soot of a fireplace.
Oh, okay.
So after you burn wood and the carbon that's left.
The super fine particles?
Yeah, the super fine particles were carbon nanotubes. So, you know, and we've been making fire as a, you know.
Since the caveman days.
Right. So, and it's sort of nanomaterials have been around, nanoparticles have been around for a long time. But definitely the advancement of microscopy has helped us understand these nanomaterials, how to manipulate these nanomaterials, how to make them. So I would say, you know, probably the most popular instruments that we use to characterize nanoparticles are things like atomic force microscopes, scanning, tunneling microscopes, TEMs, transmission electron microscopes. Those are really the things you can see that my glasses on my face cannot.
Also, some of your papers mentioned about zinc, silver, and other metallic nanoparticles as antibiotics. What raw materials do you get? Do you get the nanoparticles as raw material, or do you get brick of zinc and pulverize it to nanoparticles? How does the process work from raw material to reaching a conclusion that, yes, it can kill bacteria, the whole research
process? Yeah, so there's really, in the field of nanotechnology, there are two ways to think about creating nanoparticles, a top-down approach or bottom-up approach, right? And you described both of those in the question. So a top-down approach is, let's say you have a sheet of zinc and you use some method to basically break down that sheet into nanoparticles. You could use laser, you could use high temperatures, high pressures. So there's a chemical techniques to dissolve the zinc. There's a lot of top-down approaches where you're going from a larger material down to the small nanoparticle. And those are good and worthwhile. I think most of the people in the field, though, are doing the bottom-up approaches. Okay. And we do bottom-up approaches.
Like take atoms and go up?
Or? Yep. So okay. That's where you're really assembling a nanoparticle atom by atom.
Oh.
And that's, you know, Richard Feynman is one of the thought leaders of this field right back in the day.
Right.
And he described, you know, there's plenty of room at the bottom, and he described this bottom-up approach.
His lecture in 1969, right?
Yes.
Yeah, yep. That's considered like the creation of nanotechnology, and
absolutely.
A lot of other young scientists looked at that presentation, and then they developed
their ideas and thought processes, and absolutely. Right. And, you know, what he described in some of those speeches was the ability to take an atom like zinc that you mentioned, oxygen, because oxygen can allow you to make more zinc materials, take atom by atom and build a structure with controllable properties.
You are one of the early believers in nanomedicine. I mean, you are considered pioneer to using nanotechnology to improve medical devices. It's been mentioned many times. What interested you personally of all the fields available to nanomedicine?
Yeah, I think it started very simple for me. You know, and back when we got interested and I got interested in nanomedicine, it was more for tissue engineering.
And we are talking about 2003, 4, 5?
So yeah, even maybe a little bit before that, like the late. So I did my PhD work from 1995 to 2000. So around that time, and you know, even earlier, although I was certainly not thinking of nanomedicine at this age, but when I was 6, I got hit by a car and broke my leg, my femur, right? The largest bone in your body. And fortunately, you know, when you're young, and in this particular case, my bone healed on its own. That is not the case, of course, for older people or even more severe injuries where you need an implant. So I started thinking, you know, when I was in graduate school, why is it that our orthopedic devices, whether they're pins, a hip implant, a knee implant, why is it that they only last on average about 15 years in your body? You know, can't we do better than that is what I thought. So, you know, when I started looking at bone, and I remember getting a piece of bone from a butcher in my graduate school days, looking at it under some of these microscopes that we discussed, and I noticed that bone is made up of nanoparticles. And I was very intrigued by this. And I started looking around other parts of the body, cartilage, skin, the brain. It's all made up of nanoparticles and nanomaterials. But you contrast that with what we're implanting today, even today, you know, 20 years later. We are not implanting materials made up of nanoparticles.
Yeah,
we're implanting materials that are made up of micron particles. So if our thinking is to improve tissue growth, make implants last longer in patients, help people lead more active lives after an accident, shouldn't we be using nanoparticles? And shouldn't we be wanting to mimic the body? And that's really where it all started for me.
And today you are actually doing research on using nano coating over implants. That is one of your research areas, right?
That's right. And now, you know, not in the late 1990s, but now, you know, in the 2018, we do have FDA approved materials for, of course, for cancer, for but also in light of what I was just talking about, we now have FDA approved nanomaterials for improving bone growth. So things are progressing, not as fast as I think some of us want,
right,
but that is a big step that the FDA has approved nanoparticles to be used as coatings or as bone filler agents that can help improve bone growth.
So we're talking about your research, your interest in all these years. What do you consider, what is your biggest high? Like it's like, I know it's like asking your favorite child. It's not fair, but most satisfying, you wanted to do something, you did it, and you felt good, like greatest win.
Yeah, so that is a very tough question, right? I think in the world of research, right, we get very excited about things going on recently, right? So I would say, you know, back when I started, I was very excited about using nanoparticles to improve bone growth. So, you know, when we spun out a company and that company got FDA approval for a spinal implant that uses these kinds of materials, that was very exciting to me. You know, the first time we discovered that nanoparticles without antibiotics can kill bacteria, that was very exciting to me. I think today, as we're sitting here talking, the thing that I'm most proud of is we are pushing the field into implantable sensors. So instead of, again, to use the bone analogy, if you get a hip implant, in order for your orthopedic surgeon to know if that implant is doing well, you need to get an X-ray. You need to get a bone scan. You have to go into a hospital and get all of these tests done. To us, that is not the future of medicine. To us, the future of medicine is the hospital, is the little sensor that you can put on your implant.
Okay.
And that sensor can determine on its own if bone is growing, or are there bacteria that unfortunately got there, or is scar tissue growing, which would also be unfortunate. But that little sensor could then communicate to your cell phone or some handheld device and tell you whether it's working or not. And of course, tell the orthopedic surgeon so that the orthopedic surgeon knows what's happening to your implant or not.
You are describing the future, I believe, the way Dr. Michiru Kaku, he wrote a book, Physics of the Future, and he described healthcare. Essentially, it's the same thing.
That's right.
You have lab that is size of your thumb, and that's all you need. You get all the data.
That's right. So I often joke that I chose chemical engineering as a way to get away from electronics. But now here I'm back dealing with electronics
sensors, right? So we talked about all the good things that you have enjoyed working on. Do you have a favorite failure? That something that was very disappointing or very frustrating at the time, but eventually something good came out of it?
I think some of our failures have really come from experimental failures where we think we're modeling the body, but when we develop something in vitro, a nanoparticle to kill a cancer cell, for example, and then we go into an animal study, it fails. So, and this happens today, you know, all across the world. So I think clearly our in vitro models, our petri dish models, are not mimicking the animal, the human. You know, there's even further discontinuity when you go from typical rodent studies to humans. So I think across the board, we need better experiments. But I think other failures that occur, that have occurred in my lab, is, you know, at a university, we cannot, we don't have the ability, we don't have the skill set to commercialize things. So if we don't get buy-in from industry in what we're doing, it could be considered pointless,
right,
what we're doing.
Right.
But when we do, and when we have attracted industry's interest, that's when things have progressed, and that's when I feel like we're helping real humans with diseases.
You spoke about the industry willing to develop, take this research and take it to the next step. What is the status of nanomedicine research around the world, and where does the USA stand?
Yeah, so I think things are going quite well. You know, when nanomedicine started, you know, one of the key funding mechanisms for us in this field was the National Nanotechnology Initiative, which was instituted by President Bill Clinton in 2000. That's when a lot of funding went into the field. That's when there was a lot of research that came out. I think immediately what followed was the nano hype. So in my opinion, in the 2000s, there was a lot of people thinking, is nanomedicine over-promising? And yes, it was.
The same was the issue with biologics. In the 80s, you know, biologics, people promised so much, and then after 20 years, like, you know, where is my kidney?
Right, exactly. Yep. And tissue engineering had the same problem. Right. There was a cover of Science magazine that showed a human in which every organ was tissue engineered. We don't have that, right? That never occurred. But I think in nanomedicine, what has occurred is the entrepreneurial startup community has been very large, right? And maybe this is because the economic situation is fairly good. There's people looking for solutions proactively for many diseases. There's been promise in showing reduces of some of these diseases when using nanomaterials. So I think the entrepreneurial startup community, and of course I'm speaking to you from Boston right now, and it's pretty healthy in Boston,
yes,
the startup community. But I think when they got involved and partnered with universities, partnered with the larger companies.
Like Northeastern here.
Yep, like Northeastern where I'm employed.
Or Brown you were before.
Or Brown where I was before. There's a constant communication with startup companies, with entrepreneurs over the past, you know, 18 years that has driven this field.
How about abroad? What's the status in, say, Europe, China, Japan, Israel? How's the research, nanomedicine research, going on in those countries?
Yeah, so I think globally, when I look at what's occurring around the earth, there's an interest everywhere in nanomedicine. In fact, in the academic circles, there are conferences, you know, once a month, you know, in these areas of the world. Israel just had a big nano convention that they do every year, and I could give similar examples all
you
over the world.
You did one recently, didn't you? You and your team here?
Yeah, so we've been hosting here at Northeastern the an international nanotechnology conference in which the attendance continues to go up and interest continues to go up.
What's the status of nanomedicine research in big pharma companies?
Yeah, I think it's pretty strong. In the big pharma companies that I'm aware of, there is a lot of excitement going on, a lot of investments that are being done. There is, I think, a reliance on the smaller companies to develop a nano product much further maybe than what's occurred in the past, but they're paying attention. You know, the big pharma companies are paying attention, and we're getting a lot of phone calls, not just, you know, about our research, but in general about the field. You know, I think of industry, looking at industry participation in conferences around nanomedicine has been increasing.
So you mentioned about getting phone calls, and I assume those are for like consultancy people asking you for advice, right? So if you were to advise a venture capital company about investing in a nanomedicine company, what scientific factor would you advise them to make sure they get it right so they can avoid wasting their time and energy on, you know,
on things,
on unproductive things?
So I you know, there has been some recent news about not necessarily nano, but some companies where investors have been criticized for not doing their homework, right?
The one in California?
Yes. So Theranos, right?
Theranos, yeah.
So, you know, so I think, though, for investors, you know, independent of this situation, to, you know, pay close attention to a mechanism of action. You know, how is that nanoparticle working? You know, how is that implant that might have nano features that resemble the natural nanostructure of tissue, how is it working? Have you compared it? You know, I almost feel like I shouldn't have to say this.
Placebo, or at least the current treatment available in the market.
Has there been a demonstration that that new material is better than what exists? And what is the reason why?
Right.
You know, that I think is critically important.
Right. Absolutely. That's a really good. Uber had significant impact on taxi, Airbnb, on hospitality industry and hotels. So who are going to be taxi and hotels to your Uber and Airbnb?
Yeah, so I, you know, we mentioned this briefly before, but my mind right now is really focused on nano sensors. I do think it's the healthcare service industry that, and I'm not an alarmist. I don't want to be an alarmist, but there will be changes. You know, we're already starting to see minute clinics.
If you look at it other way, we can say you're an optimist.
Yeah. And in terms of improving personalized medicine, right? You know, and that's another important point that we haven't quite touched on is, you know, I'm a firm believer in personalized medicine because of what we discussed before. We each have slightly different immune systems. We have slightly different abilities to repair, to respond to injury, to respond to a bacteria that might be present that shouldn't be bacteria. We're all unique,
right?
For very good things.
Yes.
Our medicine needs to be unique, you know, and that's personalized medicine. And I think a way to get to personalized medicine is bring the diagnostic tools inside your body and diagnose from inside the body. If you look at all of our conventional ways of looking at disease, MRI or CAT scans, they're all external to the body, and there's limits that we are reaching in doing that. So I think the nanomedicine, you know, it already has started affecting how we treat disease, but I think we're going to start seeing over the next decade a big influence on the healthcare service industry and being able to diagnose and treat diseases from within.
Now, whenever there is a new form of therapy, patients have lots of questions, but the two questions are always at the top of the list. How much is it going to cost me? And what are the side effects? So what's your take on the cost and the side effects of nanomedicine?
Yeah, so, you know, I think it's still sort of, nanomedicine is still sort of the premium product way of thinking. But that's because I think our conventional medicine is, you know, generic. And I mean that, you know,
that
we treat every patient the same type of generic. I think there's also a certain reluctancy in our U.S. healthcare system in terms of reimbursements for some of these treatment processes. That will change with time as, you know, more and more data is generated from studies. And
that's just the economy of scale, though, right?
Yeah
you have more patients and the cost of production will go down.
Yep. And more people get involved and you have more competitors. Then I think you start seeing a driving down of costs.
What about the side effect? So one of the concerns, as you mentioned earlier in the interview, is the particles are so small they can go through cells and skin and all that stuff. So if it gets into your bloodstream, it can easily get into your bloodstream because they are so small.
Yep. So the same advantages, right, of nanoparticles can be the Achilles heel for nanoparticles, and exactly
how do we specify the public that it's going to be okay?
Yeah, so I think the only way that we we've been doing it, that I know of how to do it, is you just have to do the experiments.
Right.
Right. Okay. So you just have to show, and this is now required from the FDA. It's the journal that I'm editor of. We require this for any animal study that we publish. You have to show what's called biodistribution.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're giving a rodent a nanoparticle that contains a chemotherapeutic agent and you're treating, you know, breast cancer or a tumor, you have to show that that nanoparticle is not causing adverse effects in the liver.
Okay.
It's not crossing the blood-brain barrier and going into the brain and causing problems in the brain. You know, kidney, you have to show that it's not causing adverse effects in the kidney, the spleen, right? All of the key organs that you don't want to target, let's make sure the nanoparticles not going there and remaining safe.
Now, that is something we don't have to do right now in animal rectox study for small molecules and biologics, right? That's
right.
An additional thing we are looking to do for nanoparticles.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Which books have you given the most as gift or recommended?
So this is a great question as well, because there are so many nano medicine books now.
and
which is
and
a great sign.
None
of
them, none of them written by Richard Feynman. He just did a presentation.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, I think what this field, if you want to learn more about this field, I think you have to understand a lot about the engineering part of it. Also need to pay very close attention to the biology, your immune system. So it's books that would really have this nice coverage of the engineering context of how to make nanoparticles, how you control properties in nanoparticles, and the biology and anatomy and cellular recognition of nanoparticles.
And you recommend those books and people still talk to you?
Yeah.
You recommend books about biology, right, and anatomy. Do you have a quote that you live by or think of often?
Hmm.
Something that inspires you that you think of often?
In addition to the Richard Feynman one, there's plenty of room at the bottom, which
yes,
I love, because
yes,
oftentimes we feel like we're at the bottom.
Yeah.
I think that's a good one.
Well, you are a professor, so I have to ask you this question. What advice would you give to a graduating student or a young professional who has just joined the industry?
Oh, absolutely. So push boundaries. You know, I think...
I love it.
Yeah, too. If you're sitting in a business meeting at your company, and I'm sure the bosses will love me to say this, but if you're just accepting what people say to you and you're just agreeing to go with the status quo, I don't think your life is going to be nearly as fulfilling as what it should be.
Hmm.
And I think if you challenge the status quo, if you challenge conventional thinking, that's when discoveries happen. So asking questions, you know, in a polite way, in
so
a very
please
friendly
and thank
way.
You.
Yes. But pushing the boundary is where revolutions occur in medicine, especially.
Any ask or request for our audience? Any parting words?
No, I think, you know, if you end up doing things in nanomedicine and start making discoveries, let people know about it. Let me know about it, because I think we have to keep each other informed just as much as we're pushing those boundaries.
Professor Webster, thank you so very much for joining us. Thank you so very much.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed today's episode. Be sure to subscribe and let others know. Word of mouth is our oxygen. Visit www.ispeboston.org for the comprehensive show notes from today's episode, and also find out more ways to associate with us. Do let us know your thoughts in the comment section, and if there is someone you'd like to see as a guest on this show, thanks again for joining us today. We'll see you next time.